Montreal seems as unlikely a place for baseball as the Canadian Northwoods for orchids. Queen Elizabeth is on the money, Joan of Arc is in many hearts, and the Hockey Canadiens are worshipped as winners.
Ask any sports fan whose town has lost a team. Talk to a Hartford Whalers fan, a Seattle Supersonics fan, and for a time until they returned, a Cleveland Browns fan. It stings. And while time supposedly heals all wounds, or so the saying goes, many fans of departed teams would beg to differ on that one. Such is the case with one of the more unique major league teams of this or any other era, the Montreal Expos. From humble beginnings, to the rise to prominence, to the multicultural nature of the city and the fan base, to the heartbreak of the strike in 94, and then the ultimate loss when the team was moved to Washington, Expo fans saw and felt and continue to feel a wide range of emotions when asked about their team. And those who played for the team feel it too. Although they all played elsewhere, the Expos remain a strong part of their past and their legacy. On this week's episode of A Swing and a Belt, we explore the 36-year history of the Expos, known affectionately to their fans as Nos Amours.
Major League Baseball will be played on a regular basis for the first time in Canada next year. Montreal has won a franchise in the National League.
1969 was significant to Canadian baseball fans, especially those in Montreal. It marked the coming of the international era of Major League Baseball, the arrival of the Expos, the team destined to draw more than a quarter of a million fans, 1.25 million, in their opening year in Jerry Park.
We'll hear from a number of former players and their longtime voice, Dave Van Horn. But let's begin with a guy who knows the Expos inside and out, as an author, and long before that, as a Montreal native who grew up as a huge fan, Jonah Carey. Well, if you want to talk about the Montreal Expos and their history, the guy you've got to go to is Jonah Carey. Jonah Carey is a lot of things. He's a writer for CBS Sports. He's the author of the book with the longest title that I've ever read in my life, but it's well worth reading. You can just call it Up, Up, and Away, or you can call it Up, Up, and Away, The Kid, The Hawk, Rock, Vladdy, Pedro, Le Grand Orange, Yuppie, The Crazy Business of Baseball, and The Ill-Fated but Unforgettable Montreal Expos. Can you recite all of that from memory?
Probably. The French accent was really strong.
Oh, thank you.
Very good.
Thank you. A Canadian best-selling book, so congratulations on that. Jonah Carey, of course, is also a contributor to Sportsnet and to The Fan and Sportsnet.ca. If you don't know where to find him, you're not looking hard enough. Now, your qualifications for this particular episode of the podcast, you grew up in Montreal, mm-hmm. an insane Expo fan.
Yes.
Is that fair?
For sure. I was born in 74, so not quite old enough to get the Jerry Park experience, but very much when they became good early 80s is when I kind of hit my stride as a fan. I tell people, and it's true, the first vivid baseball memory I have is actually Blue Monday. It was the home run hit by Rick Monday in 1981, unfortunately.
Yeah. Yeah.
So lived through a lot of the 80s, a lot of Dan Bilardello kind of era, and then on to the 90s when they became really great again.
So you've got a great group of players in the 80s, as you say, and then maybe even a better group in the early 90s up through and until the 94 strike. Some very good players after, but let's say you're talking to someone who's never seen an Expo game and has no emotional attachment to Montreal or the Expos or anything like that. What made it so unique in Montreal? What made baseball such a unique experience?
It was a party, and especially even more so in the 80s and the 90s when I was a little guy. And Michael Farber has talked very eloquently about this on many occasions, but you would go in, and a lot of the fancy people that used to go to Montreal Canadiens games, men in three-piece suits and women in fur coats, were at Expos games because the Habs were having a little bit of a dip in the early 80s, and the Expos were coming on strong with Dawson and Raines and Carter and all those guys. You walk into the stadium, and it was through the metro, so you go right up through the metro, and you go into the ballpark, and there would be a German Oompa band playing German songs, because that's what they did at the old Munich bar, tavern, whatever, right in the middle of downtown, so it was just bringing the party to the ballpark. You'd go there, and there were chickens on the scoreboard, and there was the bilingual announcements, and it was so different. It wasn't Cleveland or Milwaukee, or frankly, even Toronto. Even though Toronto was a great atmosphere, different kind of thing. It stood out as unique among the entire baseball landscape.
Am I correct in saying that even when crowds lagged later on, 12,000 could sound like 40,000?
No question. Part of that was the acoustics of the ballpark. Rogers Center has it a little bit because it's a dome, but that ballpark was like weird and concrete and strange. It's got Roger Tye Bear built it, and it was it's a spaceship, a toilet bowl. Yeah. It was a weird place. And then they had these seats that used to clang on them. And people talked about the Vuvuzela controversy that came along a few years ago. People had those big horns at Olympic Stadium in, I don't know, 1979. That was always part of the furniture, too.
All right, so finish some sentences for me or educate me on certain things. Yupi has to be discussed. Was Yupi great? Was he bad, or was he so bad he's good? Like, where does Yupi fall on the spectrum of mascots in your mind?
Well, first of all, I love the origin story. There was a woman named Bonnie Erickson who used to work with Jim Henson, and she became the kind of queen, the pioneer of these mascots. So Philly Fanatic, Yupi, I believe, was the second big one out of the box for her. And so the costume itself was a big work. What is Yupi? You know, my friends and I, when we were 13, we'd go to the ballpark, and the stadium had an orange roof. We would surmise that it was a cat that got caught in some sort of lightning storm, and there was some sort of Marvel Comics-like reaction, and behold, Yupi was born. The other thing we like to say is that if you remember the 80s, former excellent hitting infielder Hubie Brooks and Yupi were never seen in the same place at the same time. So I don't know. But we did like him, and I know the mascots, like the wave and things like that, can be controversial for people, but to me, he's for kids, you know, and he knows how to goof. And famously, he got so under Tommy Lasorda's skin that Lasorda ordered Bob Davidson to chuck him from a game. And I wrote a whole column about that. It's one of the most ridiculous things I've ever seen.
And balking Bob Davidson did throw him out of the game, didn't
he? Sure did, because it's Bob Davidson, yeah.
Time is called. They want Yupi off the Dodger dugout. He's bugging the Dodger players, and Tom Lasorda is out. And third base umpire Bob Davidson is throwing Yupi out of the ballgame. He wants him off the Dodger dugout. Tommy Lasorda has put up a complaint. This will draw the ire of the fans. And they want Buck Rogers out to get Yupi out of there. Buck is sitting down. Here comes Davidson running over, and Buck's going to make Davidson come over and say, "What do you?" Or no, they're calling somebody from security over.
They're going to call security and remove him from the ballpark.
Well, we've seen it all now, huh? Yupi's been thrown out of the game, off the Dodgers dugout.
It must have been a culture shock. You're going to Expo games, maybe thinking, or did you think, hey, this is baseball, and then you turn on the TV or you start going to other ballparks when you're older. When did you realize, hey, our version of Major League Baseball is a little bit different than the other versions?
I think that's part and parcel of being a Montrealer. I feel like every team comes from a place, and if the Blue Jays, and I'm not rooting for this, but if they moved to Oklahoma, I don't know people would remain Jays fans because it's not the same. Montreal was very much of a place, and skipping ahead for a bit, people have asked me, are you a Nationals fan? I don't dislike the Nationals, but we're talking about a different thing. To me, the Expos being unique in the baseball landscape was the same thing as being from Montreal. Of course, I spoke two languages fluently growing up. Of course, you could go to the bars at 15 and it was no problem. Of course, culture was the way it was. Of course, you had cobblestone streets in old Montreal. So it always felt that way. And yes, very much so. My buddies and I, especially in college around then, we started going on road trips to Cleveland and Detroit and all these places. It was great. Super fun. But totally different.
Totally different.
Even the food. There was no poutine at the time. There was no smoked meat. None of that stuff existed.
Give me, not necessarily the two or three best players the Expos have had, but the two or three most significant or most beloved players, in your opinion, that the Expos have had.
You know, it's a fun debate because they're sort of different eras. Like Carter has to stand out as probably the signature guy because he was the fan favorite. He took upon himself. And there was some rumbling behind the scenes that some other guys were like, what's this guy? His nickname, a little bit in a derogatory sense, used to be Lights, because when the lights came on, there was Carter. Even though, was he a better player than Dawson or Raines? Those guys are Hall of Famers in their own right.
0-2 to count. There's a drive in the deep right field way by Grayla. The base hit. Here comes a runner on third. And Carter, with a count of 0-2, has put the Expos into the lead. Look at. Holy cow, what an emotional moment here. Listen to these people. Watch Carter.
Rusty Staub preceded him, and Rusty's such a cool story. Here's a guy who comes in. He was a whole cloak and dagger trade and how they got him in the first place, and he becomes the signature player on a miserably bad team. He would bring cooking utensils on the road. He was a gourmand. He was an interesting guy. He learned French.
Right.
He lived in a family's basement.
Dear to the fans is Rusty Staub, who, when a trade seemed to be falling through, refused to return to Houston. He loves the fans for sticking with the club through a 20-game losing streak.
some people really wanted us to lose four or five more games to set a world record, you know, or the establish the record in the major leagues, because of the fact that it just seemed like the thing to do after losing 20. But we really weren't for that. We're glad we, you know, discontinued the losing streak at 20 games. But I really can't tell you enough about the way the fans here have made most of the players here feel.
So with Staub to Carter to that kind of hybrid team that had Walker and Grissom and Alou and all those guys, but maybe Pedro would be the guy modern era, right? Pedro had such a personality. His first home start, he throws seven perfect innings, hits Reggie Sanders. Reggie Sanders is the first guy on base. Sanders is so mad, he charges the mound because Pedro was a headhunter.
Meantime, the Montreal Expos must have been satisfied about one bit of news on Monday. That was the news that Cincinnati's Reggie Sanders was suspended for 5 games for charging the hill to fight with Pedro Martinez last week. Martinez was working on a perfect game in the 8th, but he hit Sanders on the arm, almost certainly a mistake in a perfect game. Sanders comes up to the hill anyway, and they go at it. The Reds outfielder will be allowed to play while he appeals the suspension.
And then the last guy would have been Vladimir Guerrero, and of course the legacy carries on with the Montreal-born Vladimir Guerrero Jr., right, who might literally be a Blue Jay before this podcast airs.
And who hit, and this is setting the bar low, I guess, has hit the most famous home run in spring training history, it would appear.
For sure he has. It was such a cool story. Walk off for the Jays on the last game of spring training.
Do you ever think Montreal gets a Major League Baseball team back? We're about the same. In our lifetime, do we see the Montreal Expos again?
I think it is quite possible, and I wouldn't have said that a few years ago, and I'll give you a quick backstory on this. I wrote a book about the Tampa Bay Rays previously, and my editor was an American who'd gone to McGill and became an Expos fan in the late 90s. So that book ended up doing pretty well, and we would kibitz, and he'd say, you got to write a book about the Expos. And I said, literally nobody's going to read that. I don't even think my buddies are going to read this book. And he would keep on me and keep on me. And finally, twisted my arm, I said, okay, I'm going to do it, but it's going to be a money loser for you. And that was 2011, 2012 when I started that project. And that's when Gary Carter passed away, and things started happening. Warren Cromartie comes back to the city. He starts doing some things and uncovering some rocks. Then they start having some events. They start having these galas every year. And then it culminates with exhibition games at Olympic Stadium. And granted, a lot of people drowned on the 401. A lot of Jays fans are there. But there were a lot of people in Expos gear, 50,000 strong for a useless game at the end of March. Very interesting. And so from that, we've had movements behind the scenes, which is what it's going to take. So Stephen Bronfman, who's Charles Bronfman's son, Charles Bronfman, the original owner of the Expos, he's involved. Rogers' rival, who we won't mention by name, but that large telecommunication company, there's no secret that they want in, because there is potential there, because sports and media are an obvious synergy, because that's sort of the one DVR-proof thing that you have left, right? So all of that could happen behind the scenes. To me, the mechanism, though, has to be Major League Baseball. Is it going to be relocation? Well, what's going to happen in Tampa Bay and Oakland? We'll see. Otherwise, it's expansion, because if you have 30 teams, you have 15 in each league. You have the Padres playing the Twins. It makes no sense. It's a natural. Montreal and Charlotte, Montreal and Portland, Montreal and Mexico City. And I am obviously biased, but people like Tyler Kepner and respectable baseball writers have asked Commissioner Manfred, what do you think? And he's always said, Montreal is at the top of the list. If we go to relocation, if we go to expansion, this is a metro area of 3.5-4 million. They have experience there. They had bad owners before. It wasn't bad fans. They were not supported by ownership. After Bronfman left, there is a shot. So I would have said impossible in the past. Now I say, find somebody with $2 billion Canadian, and I am confident that it'll happen.
I feel the same way that you do, but the commissioner also says, but they've got to sort out Oakland in Tampa Bay before they consider expansion. And I think Tampa Bay's lease runs through 2027, I believe.
Correct.
At the Trop. So we're still 9 years away. If that holds, we're still 9 years away from even beginning the discussion. Of course, if they do come back, even though they're a National League team, a National League market, now that Houston's in the American League, it would be very interesting to me, and I think it would be a natural, even if historically it doesn't make sense, for Montreal to join the American League and be with Toronto.
It would be so fun, and of course, if the Tampa Bay Rays move there, this is a Venn diagram that can only exist for one person in the universe. Who else has written a book about one ill-begotten franchise and another, and now they converge? So I guess so. But of course, it would be fun. And road trips to Boston and New York, obviously, if you're an Expos fan, would be great. So it would be, man, it would be tough competition, but it would be a natural.
Yes. The book's called Up, Up, and Away. It's terrific. Read it. Listen to him. Find him. Jonah Carey is everywhere. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dan.
When we come back, we'll hear from several former Expos who fondly remember their time in Montreal, but also wonder about what might have been.
The city of Montreal.
And here's the left fielder, Mac Jones.
Jones.
Deep, deep.
right side.
A no-hitter. A no-hitter for Bill Stoneman.
Bill Stoneman has pitched a no-hitter again.
Brad Hunt hit on the ankle. He wants the baseball.
The bag for one over the
ankle.
It has been over 20 years since Montreal was awarded a National League franchise. We, all of us, have our memories of those 20 years. Memories that make us smile, memories that make us cry, memories that thrill us, memories of a steady stream of extraordinary personalities. Well, stay with us for a little while. We're going to try and rekindle those memories for you, the good ones and the bad ones, reintroduce you to some of those characters then and as they are today.
Sportsnet.ca, your online home for everything sports. Dunks, dives, and deeks. Catch highlights, news, and the best storytelling in Canada. Featuring all the stories you want to read in one place. Plus, exclusive podcasts including 31 Thoughts and At the Letters. Canada's deepest roster of storytellers. Sportsnet.ca, your online home for everything sports.
As we heard from Jonah Carey, being an Expo fan was a unique experience. Well, the same can be said for being a player in Montreal.
What was it like being a Montreal Expo? Well, I guess it was...
You know, with the chicken sticking their head, though, the black and white scoreboard making a little noise when a throw over to first, or Yuppie falling off the dugout and breaking his nose and having to be in the trainer's room for attention.
Dan, I've got great memories from Montreal, having spent 32 years, good part of my adult life there, broadcasting Expos baseball, and it was a wonderful experience.
I've yet to talk to anyone affiliated with the team who didn't smile as soon as I brought up their time in Montreal. Let's take a trip down memory lane now, beginning with Joe Siddle, a Windsor, Ontario native who broke into the big leagues with the Expos in 1993.
After a week of wondering when, after getting into two games as a substitute, this time Joe Siddle donned the mask for real. This was his first major league stunt.
Being a Canadian and getting to the big leagues with the Montreal Expos, it's a dream come true to get to the big leagues as a player, but when you do it in your native country, that was extra special for me. I think also the fact that when I got called up, it was late July in 93, the Expos were not in the race at all. I think they were 12 or 13 games out of it. I was a part-time player in AAA Ottawa, and I remember coming into the clubhouse after a game. We had a tough loss in Ottawa. I'm sitting at my locker. I wasn't even playing that day. And Mike Waddy was my manager. Came in the clubhouse, and the manager had to walk through the clubhouse to get to his office. And he looked right at me and basically said, "Follow me." And I'm thinking, what did I do wrong? Well, it was me and Gil Heredia walking into his office, and he said, "You guys are going to the big leagues. You're going to Pittsburgh tomorrow." I'll never forget that. Made my debut at Three River Stadium in Pittsburgh, but then we came home to Montreal. Well, we went on quite a run that year, and all of a sudden it was mid-September, and we were in a pennant race. Ended up finishing a couple games back of the Phillies in second place in the NL East. That was special for me because here I was just getting to the big leagues, playing in Montreal, and, you know, not known for the largest crowds in the world, but that place was packed pretty good a lot of that month of September because it was a pennant race. Came up a little short, but that was pretty fun.
Was there something, because of the culture, the language, customs, whatever, I mean, it's not your typical baseball marketplace. Was there something about that that made it stand out to you?
Less so for me because I was Canadian. I took French in high school, and I'm not saying I spoke it beautifully, but I could get by. I had more fun with my teammates from all the different cultures, not just the Americans, trying to get by with the French language. And I thought that was fun because, for the most part, they were fun stories. It wasn't like they didn't like Montreal because of the language. They thought it was cool. And then I think more and more when guys got out and went out for dinner, when families were in town, they absolutely got to see the city and absolutely loved the city.
Darren Fletcher was already a big leaguer when he became an Expo in 1992. He would remain with Montreal through the 97 season before moving on to the Blue Jays. Here is his response when I asked him about what made being an Expo so unique.
It's got to be the culture, definitely. The language, the culture. The ballpark was also a unique spot, too. I mean, you go to that ballpark, it was just an odd-looking, strange structure. I mean, and the colors, too. I think of one as a kid, I think of Montreal Expos. I think of the tricolor of the blue, red, and white. I mean, I think it was a fantastic uniform. It was a unique organization. I think it'd be great if they could get another team, but it was very unique. It had a very European feel.
There are some players who, although they may not have been in Montreal very long, remain fan favorites to this day. Rex Hudler, who only spent 2 years there in 1988 and 1989, is one of those guys.
Dan, for me, I was a 10-year minor leaguer at the time, and I looked at that opportunity to play in Montreal as this is it. This is my last shot. I'm going to make it. And it just so happened to be, I didn't care where it was, but it happened to be north of the border. And I got there, I kind of tiptoed. And as they put me in that hotel downtown Montreal, I couldn't believe how clean the city was. I got on the metro to go to the ballpark, and you could eat your breakfast, lunch, and dinner off the floor. I was staggered by how cool the city looked.
Another huge fan favorite was Terry Francona, who broke into the big leagues with the Expos in 1981 and would likely have become a star had it not been for a serious knee injury early in his career.
We're here at Olympic Stadium with Terry Francona, outstanding ball player for the Expos. And I suppose everybody where we live, Terry, from the Northern Tier, wants to know, coming off the injuries, are you healthy now?
Oh, yeah, I feel real good. You know, I don't think I'll ever be like an 18-year-old kid anymore, but I'm real happy with the progress my legs have made, and I think I could all, you know, everything I expected, I've gotten, and I'm real pleased with it.
Tito was my broadcast partner on Sunday Night Baseball in 2012, and when we sat down to chat earlier this season, I reminded him of a story from that year that illustrates how popular he was in Montreal. We were at dinner somewhere on a Saturday night before a game, and a friend of mine called me and he said, listen, I'm with my brother-in-law, and he's from Montreal. I just told him you work with Tito, and you have no idea how much he loves. And I came to you and I said, there's a guy on the phone who wants to talk to you. And you were like, how would anybody remember me from Montreal? And we talked about this. You were beloved in Montreal. And I know sometimes you know, you're very self-deprecating. You don't take any praise or anything. But people in Montreal loved you. And I'm wondering what your feeling was for Montreal when you were there.
A couple things. One, I loved Montreal. I mean, how do you not? Yeah. The thing I think, I wanted to play so bad. I was young and, you know, I hurt my knee in my first year and I probably said a couple stupid things, immature things, you know, because I wanted to play so bad. But the city of Montreal, I hope they get a team back because I don't think people realize how much they loved baseball. They didn't always understand it. In fact, I think that's part of the reason people liked me. I'd hit that ground ball with a runner on second and move the runner with one out.
Right.
And they, what a team guy.
That's funny. What made it unique? Was it the mascot? Was it the ballpark? Was it the French-English combination? What made Montreal
well,
special?
Well, one, the city had so much. I mean, and not that I'm ever going to go check out the culture, but it just had so much personality. And, you know, before I got up there, everybody was talking about the French-English. I found that people were so friendly. And once they knew you were part of the Expos, remember they used to, it was Nos Amour, mm-hmm. and they did, they loved the Expos. We take the metro to the ballpark every day. It lets right. you out there, P-Nuff, right at the ballpark. And it was my first major league ballpark, my first major league team. So it's more kind of like a family atmosphere.
That it was, seemingly from day one in 1969. But as time passed, being unique was not enough. The Expos had to start winning. And as the organization grew, as the infrastructure evolved, the Expos developed the dominant farm system in all of baseball. Homegrown talent began appearing in the big leagues. Gary Carter, Andre Dawson, Tim Raines, just to name a few. There was the joy of making the postseason in the split season year of 1981, only to be followed by the heartbreak of Rick Monday's home run, sending the Dodgers to the World Series.
Now in the stretch.
And sending the Expos home.
Here's the 3-1 pitch, and it swung on, fly ball, center field, Dawson going back onto the warning track, Dawson at the wall, that ball is a home run! That ball is out of here, and a home run for Rick Monday, and the Dodger bench clears to congratulate Rick Monday, who has hit a two-out home run here in the ninth inning, and it appeared...
Through the rest of the 80s, the Expos were often good, but never quite good enough. But the farm system, combined with some shrewd trades, would lead them into a new era of prominence in the early 90s, as young players like Larry Walker, Marquise Grissom, Moises Alou, Pedro Martinez, and others began arriving on the scene. One of those players was a young man loaded with talent who, like many others, would start his career in Montreal but wind up moving on before long. Cliff Floyd.
What a welcome back for Cliff Floyd, who's leading off here in the bottom half of the second inning. For years, Montreal Expo fans have been saying goodbye to their veteran players. Now they finally get one back.
And I think there's a little larger crowd than they might have had normally here to greet him, too.
Last played here in 1996.
We had a great team, obviously, in 94. I got there, it was a part of something that was, I thought could have been, you know, a dynasty. And the fans saw it as well. But, you know, us going to the big old Olympic Stadium was a little different for everybody. But, you know, it was still where they appreciated what the product we had on the field. We played the game on a different level, but I think they had seen early on with some of the guys they had, obviously the Hawk and so on and so forth. But, you know, we had some studs, man, and the fans came out in droves. I remember getting up there, my first year and thinking 50,000+ people in this place. You know, it was smoky, it was dark, but the fans were on another level excited about that Expos team.
And of course they were. In 1994, the Expos were loaded. The entire team was young, athletic, and getting better and better. They were good, and they knew it. The Expos were battling the Atlanta Braves, led by the incomparable pitching trio of Greg Maddux, Tom Glavine, and John Smoltz, all future Hall of Famers. The Braves led the NL East for the early part of the season, but then the Expos got hot. During an 8-game winning streak in July, they overtook the Braves and won 20 of 23 to run their record to 74-40, a full 6 games ahead of Atlanta. But that day, August 12th, disaster struck.
The Expos leave the field in first place, yet wondering if their best season ever's in jeopardy. Even so, they're prepared to sit it out for as long as it takes.
It doesn't matter how we've been playing. Of course, this is probably our best year playing, but we're talking about the whole game of baseball. You know, we didn't want a strike. We didn't want this to happen, but we have no other choice but to go out and take care of ourselves in the game of baseball.
Every game is every game, and, you know, if this is the last game until we strike, which, you know, it probably will be, so be it. You know, we've got to do what we've got to do.
There's a little bit more intelligence on both sides than people really give credit for. And I think when everything's said and done and the rhetoric stops and they really get down to, you know, really laying out some facts on both sides, that we'll get something done.
Next, a news conference held earlier today at the White House looking at the baseball strike. President Clinton named former Labor Secretary William Ussery to mediate discussions between players and team owners. You'll hear from Donald Fear, Executive Director of the Players Association, Labor Secretary Robert Reich, Acting Baseball Commissioner Bud Selig, and Mr. Ussery.
He will introduce Bud Selig, and he will introduce Don Fear. This will be for the record and on camera. Secretary Reich.
Good afternoon. For the last 2 months, the sounds of silence have replaced the boys of summer. For the first time since 1904, there will be no World Series.
The season would be halted. A player strike would begin. And several weeks later, Commissioner Bud Selig announced that because no settlement had yet been reached, the entire postseason would be canceled.
Believe me, there's nobody on the North American continent that wants a work stoppage less than I do. I can tell you I've spent many sleepless nights worrying about it.
The best team in baseball would not have an opportunity to try to make a run in October. Once again, Darren Fletcher.
We were the best team in baseball record-wise, and we were the ones that we just kept pushing that year, and we were winning a lot of games even as we got closer to it. But Dan, I think everyone knew, when you listen to the rhetoric from the union and the rhetoric from the owners that year, we knew something big was on the horizon, and you just had that feel like this could be something major. I felt that, and a lot of us did. We didn't want to believe it, but we all felt like this could be a long work stoppage. But yeah, it was very disappointing. I remember when, I think we were in Pittsburgh, and Kevin Malone was the general manager and came in and said, well, if you guys go on striving, that's it. You know, it just, you know, just the finality of it on when we had such a great run. It was, I guess, the most joyous I've ever felt in the big leagues. I made an all-star team in 94. The Expos were the talk of Major League Baseball at the all-star break. We had 6 or 7 all-stars that year. We were kind of the headline team. Everyone was talking about the young stars. You know, Moises Alou hits the double off the wall to win the all-star game.
First at-bat of the night for him. Swinging a drive into the gap in left center field. And up against the fence. This could do it. Being waved home is Gwynn. They got a play to Rodriguez. Safe! Safe!
It was super exciting. It just felt so good to be a part of this organization. We were young, and then within weeks, it flipped around to be some of the most disappointing memories that I could ever think of playing. So it was very odd, emotional roller coaster type year.
It's something that still hurts deeply for Expos fans and remains top of mind for the players who were there at the time. And it was the first thing that Maple Ridge, British Columbia native Larry Walker brought up when I asked him to recall his time as an Expo. Well, Larry, you had six great years of your great career. The first 6 years were in Montreal from 1989 through 1994. That's where you began your major league career, started developing into a star. And everybody I've talked to talks about how unique an experience it was to play in Montreal. For you, when you think back to your days as an Expo specifically, what kind of memories come back to you?
Well, I think the first one that probably jumps out for all of us that were on the team was the 94 team. You know, that's going a few years into my career there, but that was the year that was both quite gratifying as we were playing along and then very disappointing as the strike hit and it all came to an end.
Before we get into 94, and I know so much of this for everybody who played there revolves around 94, when you came up in 89, I mean, this was all new to you because you'd never been anywhere else in the major leagues at all. But, you know, what were your first few days like in Montreal, being in Quebec and the culture and the ballpark? It just seemed like a really unique place to be a Major League Baseball player.
It was. You know, like I say, the team was kind of new, I guess, as far as not being able to win. You know, it was a struggle trying to get a winning franchise on the field. And when I got called up in 89, the team, you know, had some opportunities. And I was a skinny little nervous Canadian kid that was getting a chance to play in the big leagues. And you know, it was exciting. Montreal welcomed me with open arms and warm ovations. And being a Canadian, I felt obviously right at home because I was.
So even though you were from BC, they embraced you more than the typical ball player because you were Canadian?
I think a little bit more. I think if I was French Canadian, it would have been even more. But as Denny Boucher found when he got there, they laid out the flag for him and everything on the pitcher's mound. So it was a little bit more involved for that.
Well, you and I and everybody else who grew up in Canada learned a little bit of French growing up in school. How was your French when you got to Montreal and were you able to put it to use at all?
I was horrible. I never really got the hang of it while I was in school. And I did spend a winter in Montreal trying to learn the language. I had a tutor that would come to the house daily and once again, I couldn't figure it out. We spent hours there and I guess learning another language other than English is just not for me.
What was the in-game experience like? Some of your teammates have talked about whether it's Youpi or whether it's some of the stuff going on the scoreboard or the fans banging the chairs. What was the experience like during a game in Montreal?
Well, the fact that you touched on all three of those things was always a treat. You know, with the chicken sticking their head though, the black and white scoreboard making a little noise when a throw over to first or Youpi falling off the dugout and breaking his nose and having to be in the trainer's room for attention, or just the fans themselves, but not the fans in the stands, but the fans in the ceiling that were up there running, because sometimes the seats weren't too filled, so we would actually hear the fans in the ceiling turning on as the air was moving around.
Wow. When you would go out for dinner or be out at a movie or something in the city, what were the fans like when they recognized you and came up to you?
Oh, always grateful. They're a nice bunch, and like you say, they would come up and be polite, ask for an autograph, take a picture, but always first class no matter where I went.
Did you have a feeling, Larry, going into 94? I mean, so many good young players. Everybody was in their 20s except for Jeff Fusaro. He was like 31, and he was the old man on the team among the, you know, the main contributors, the core group of the Expos. Did you have a feeling going into 94 that it had a chance to be a very special season?
Well, I think you have that feeling every season that you – take the field to start after spring training, and until you really get things rolling, which we did early, you always think that way. But once we got going, it was the only time other than when I got traded to the Cardinals in 04 that you actually feel like you're going to go out in the field and you feel like you got a chance to win. We actually took the field basically knowing we're going to win, and that's an amazing feeling when you go out there and have confidence like that as a group. As an individual, it's one thing, but as a group, we were really just one big-headed monster that would go out there and take everybody on.
What was the camaraderie like between the guys on that team?
Oh, great. Like I say, we were all young, and we could all relate to the things around our ages, you know, and just getting together on and off the field. You know, it was a case that didn't matter what color you were, what nationality you were, or if you're a position player or a pitcher. You know, everybody was good to everybody.
If you can refresh my memory, in the days leading up to August the 12th, did you guys think,
there's going to be a strike, or did you guys think they're going to figure this out and we're going to keep playing?
Well, we kind of go by word of mouth and what I believe our player rep was John Wetland at the time, and going by what they would tell us. And that was, hey, 2 weeks and we're going to be back on this thing, 2 weeks at the most. You know, they'll get this thing resolved and then we'll get rolling again. And as time went by, you know, we just sat there waiting and waiting. But, you know, at the beginning, there was never any thought of the season being canceled, not once.
Next year, hard to believe, next year will be 25 years from 1994. I don't know if there's anybody around to organize a reunion, but, you know, have you heard anything? Do you think there's any chance of a 25th year reunion of that great 94 team somewhere?
Yeah, I don't know. I know we did a little thing up in Montreal when they first started doing those exhibition games there, and I think it was maybe the 20-year anniversary that a bunch of us got together up there and before a game and went on the field and had a little banquet and everything. And I tell you, the excitement and the noise that place made when we got introduced brought back a lot of great memories.
Right fielder number 33, Larry Walker.
You go to Colorado and you play against Montreal, always a little bit different, I think, for a player to play against his original team. And you had a three home run game against the Expos at one point. What was it like playing against the Expos?
Well, when I went back, as Montreal fans sometimes do, they booed me. So as a normal thing, and I think my first at bat, I don't know what I did, grounded out or whatever, and I came back, and I remember telling, I think maybe Walt Weiss, I said, can you believe they're booing me? I'm going to go deep here and just shut them up, and sure enough, I did.
This one is hit a long ways, and it is gone. 7-0 Rockies. Larry Walker is in fuego.
And then I went two more times. I went deep that game.
Larry Walker, make it three! Wow! Now they're cheering in Montreal.
Hats are flying out, as in the hat trick.
So it was kind of funny that, as one of the announcers said, the jeers turned to cheers after I hit my third one.
The jeers have turned to cheers here in Montreal.
They finally let loose and applauded me.
I would hope so, after all you did in your 6 years there. Do you still, whether it's in Florida or anywhere, do you still have the odd Expo fan recognize you, come up to you and chat with you a little bit?
Well, I tell you, as we're talking right now, I'm signing fan mail right now as I sit here. I got an enormous box full that I'll never get caught up on, but I try to do a few a day, and I read every letter that comes, and there's a lot from Montreal that come through, and talking about the days there and how they wish the franchise would come back and they could have another shot at it, which we all hope could happen.
Do you think it could? Do you think there's a chance they'll get a team again?
I think if the cards fall right and then a new ballpark can be built downtown and they can arrange that, I don't see why not. I think you and I both know some teams that are out there right now that are playing that are drawing zero fans to the game and getting hardly any support. And they're still, as far as I see, going the same path as the old Expos were and got pushed out of the league. So I think some of these teams could be pushed out and Montreal could redo what they had up there with a new ballpark downtown and be successful.
It would be great to see, as you know better than most, as you just told us about, that franchise meant a lot to people, even all these years later, and not just in Montreal. Many fans all across Canada who really loved the Expos. Larry, thanks for joining us. Thanks for helping us remember the Expos.
You got it. You're welcome, Dan.
When we come back, more perspective from former Montreal Gazette columnist Jeff Blair and the longtime voice of the Expos, Dave Van Horn. Looking to stream the Blue Jays this season? Sportsnet Now might be the product for you. Available to anyone in Canada over the internet, Sportsnet Now gives you 24/7 access to Sportsnet channels, as well as content not available on TV. You can stream on the go or at home on your big screen from the most popular devices, including smartphones and tablets, Xbox, Chromecast, and the Apple TV app. Simply say, "Hey Siri, play the Blue Jays game."
You can catch the Blue Jays-Yankees game on Rogers Sportsnet at 7.05 p.m.
Sign up for as long as you want and cancel whenever you'd like. And it's free for Sportsnet TV subscribers. Plus, in addition to the Blue Jays, you also get Blue Jays Central, Jays in 30, and much more. Visit snnow.ca for more details. As we continue our look at the Expos and their time in Montreal, very pleased to be joined by a guy I know very well. He is the host of everything you can host, basically. It's the Jeff Blair Show. It's Baseball Central, the co-host of The Lead, new podcast with Stephen Brunt, you name it. Either he's done it or he's aspiring to do it one way or the
other. Pretty much.
Yeah.
That's a good way to put it.
So that's
never too old to aspire.
That's why I'm not sitting with my back to him right now. Jeff Blair, who covered the Expos full-time with the Montreal Gazette from 1989 to 1997. I've talked to a lot of people. Managers, players, media, and everybody's got their own story about Montreal. Every place is special when you've been there a while, but it really seems like being an Expo meant something special and unique to everybody who was around that franchise at the time.
Yeah, I think a lot of that had to do with the fact that a lot of those players came up together. Now, and I'm thinking specifically of the teams that I spend a lot of time around. The Expos went through a couple of phases. Of course, the team of the 80s, same thing. A lot of those guys came up together. They kind of lost their way a little bit, I would say, late 80s, 90s. I mean, you started to see guys like Otis Nixon and Rex Hudler come from other organizations and really put their imprint. Of course, Dennis Martinez coming from another organization, resurrecting his career. But I would say around the time they started drafting guys like Cliff Floyd and Rondell White, you started to see a return to the we've kind of all come up through the system together, and as a result, we're all in this together mentality. Again, I think that's a product of the economics of the game, but it was also the product, I think, of when David Dombrowski took over as general manager, sort of the increasing influence of guys like Gary Hughes, Dan Duquette, Frank Wren, Neil Huntington. These were all guys who were brought into the organization. And the Expos went from sort of a place where you went to resurrect your career to a place where you went to start your career and then, of course, move on when you became a free agent right, to make real money.
Whenever we, you or I or anybody, when we go to do a ball game, we'll talk to broadcasters or writers from the other team. Hey, what's going on with your team? And tell me about this, tell me about that. When media members would come to Montreal and talk to you, not about the talent per se, but about the city or the ballpark or anything, what was the thing that stood out to them that made Montreal different than any other major league city?
Visiting writers loved coming to Montreal. The players' approach would be that they loved post-game in Montreal. They didn't enjoy playing the games at Olympic Stadium.
Right.
But I think most of them enjoyed, I would say, the hours between 11 p.m. after the game is over until 11 a.m. in the morning. There was a real love for Montreal. The writers, and especially the baseball lifers, they like coming to Olympic Stadium because Olympic Stadium, at some point, it became comfortable with its quirks, right? The scoreboard was antiquated. They never really did update it. They used to put these chickens on the board every time anybody'd throw the ball over to first base. And they were literally, they had a guy holding a chicken on a stick, and he would move it in front of a TV camera like that, and the chicken would bounce up and down on the black and white scoreboard. I mean, that was it. And when I first got there and saw it, I was kind of embarrassed by this. And, you know, and I thought, oh, God, this is so tacky. And then I looked around, I thought, you know what? Everybody loves this. And the players used to get a kick out of it as well. I think that there was a real sense of difference to the Expos and to that city that I don't think writers even necessarily got when they came to Toronto. I think they sort of looked at Toronto as Chicago with customs, right? You had to go
right
to, whereas Montreal was completely different.
Was it Europe, or just was it different than anything else?
It was different. It had a different vibe. It was really sexy. You know, there was a lot going on in that city. And the teams always seemed to have, I mean, they had great personalities, right? And there was always some story going on that involving the Expos that people really seemed to latch onto. And the other thing, too, is, I mean, the Expos, for the longest time, they played exciting baseball. They really did. There were very few years where the Expos were dull. You know, there was always a sense of energy around the team. Even when things were falling apart, you still had the idea that something weird would happen in Montreal. I mean, I can remember when Major League Baseball was running the team and Frank Robinson was managing the team. I can remember fans started throwing stuff in the field in one of the final games, at Olympic Stadium. And there's Frank Robinson basically coming out of the dugout, walking down the first baseline into right field. And he's Frank Robinson, a pretty scary guy. And he's yelling at people to stop throwing stuff.
Okay, guys, I don't have a lot, but I have just a little bit. One of the fellas was meeting with the umpires and talking on the phone here right by the Expos clubhouse. And he was mentioning with Jack McKeon and Frank Robinson, basically saying that if another couple of golf balls come on this field, they're going to probably cancel this ball game. And that would be an absolutely terrible end to this franchise here in Montreal. So again,
there was always a sense that something weird would happen. Either the roof, when it was working, would get stuck and you'd have a domed stadium with a rain delay in it, or part of the stadium would collapse. You never got the sense that it was just going to be another night when you went to Olympic Stadium.
Okay, here's a question you can't get wrong.
Okay.
If the strike hadn't happened,
yes,
what would Montreal baseball have looked like from August 12th, 94 into however far into the future you want to take it?
I'm in the minority here. I don't think anything would have changed. I don't think they were ever going to get a new ballpark built in Montreal. The one thing the Expos always lacked was a political champion. And it wasn't that big a deal when Charles Bronfman owned the team, because Charles Bronfman had enough money that could overcome it. But when Claude Brochu took over the team, and when they needed government financing to get the new stadium built, the new stadium was key to making Montreal succeed. I really believe that. And they never had that individual who'd stand up to the provincial government or to the federal government, although the province was more a focal point then, and really champion. You know, really champion the cause of the Expos, of getting a new stadium. I mean, when they cobbled together this limited partnership and Jeffrey Loria was an owner, you know, the combined wealth of the people in the partnership was astronomical. I mean, the Solidarity Fund, the Quebec Labor Federation Pension Fund, it could buy Canada at that point. But those people were essentially in it for $10 million, right? Here's a check for $10 million. Don't come back to me. So even though at that time the ownership group had some of the best and brightest of Quebec businessmen, serious people, there was never anybody to really move to the forefront and get the stadium done. And honestly, I don't think that would have changed. Even if the Expos had gone on to win the World Series, attendance, they probably would have got a boost the next year.
They don't re-sign Walker. They don't, or who else left after 94?
Grissom, yeah. Walker.
They don't retain any of those guys, you think, if they win the World Series?
No. I think guys would have moved on. And again, it's a minority opinion, but I just think that there were so many structural issues with baseball in Montreal that even a World Series win wouldn't have overcome it.
We all know baseball wants to get from 30 to 32 teams. It makes everything easier on every level. Do you think Montreal will ever get a team back?
I thought they never would. About 3 years ago, when we started to hear that Stephen Bronfman and Mitch Garber, who I don't know what his title is with Caesars Acquisitions, but he's made a lot of money in the gaming industry. He's a multi-billionaire by now. He's a big baseball fan. He used to actually host a show on CJD, on the Montreal radio station, and I'd go on the show with him. Mitch Melnick was on with him. Elliot Price was on him. Mitch's uncle was a lawyer who represented Tim Raines. So Mitch has a real baseball background. The fact that he and Stephen Bronfman are involved in the group made me think, like 3 years ago, I started going from saying, I'll never see baseball back in Montreal in my lifetime, to thinking that could happen in 6 years. The most recent civic election saw Denny Coderre lose. The new mayor who came in, very left-wing, focused on a lot of other things beside the ballpark. I thought that was the death knell for it, but we've heard in the past couple of months that she's had some meetings with Stephen Bronfman and Mitch Garber, and she seems to be a little more amenable to addressing a stadium issue at some point down the road. So I've gone from thinking no chance, it's going to be there in 6 years, no chance in hell, to thinking that there probably will be baseball back in Montreal at some point. I have no doubt it will support it.
Is it a chicken and egg thing, though, where they've got to get a shovel in the ground before baseball commits, and baseball won't commit till they put a shovel in the ground?
You know, it's interesting. We talked to Rob Manfred about this, his first year as commissioner, when he came to Toronto on opening day. And Rob's kind of an interesting guy because, you know, I think he understands that very few people are going to build a stadium on spec. And what he told us, and I have no reason to believe this has changed, is, you know, I need to see a good faith gesture. I need to see the funding's in place. This is the plan for the stadium. He said, I'd be prepared to entertain. And again, that's him. I don't know how the other owners feel, but he seemed to suggest he'd be prepared to entertain putting a team in Montreal even if ground hadn't been turned. And if it meant playing in Olympic Stadium for a year, that's fine. But I think he's smart enough to realize that nobody is going to start building a stadium on spec.
And not in this country, for
not
sure.
Not in this country, yeah. For sure. Yeah. And that's a big change from the way Bud Selig approached things.
Do you think if they do get a team, I believe this, if they do get a team one way or another, mm-hmm. and I don't know how, I think they're going to wind up in the Blue Jays division. Now, whether that means Tampa yeah. Bay becomes Montreal or it's expansion 32, I don't know. But they've kind of got to be, don't you think?
Oh, I think so. Absolutely. Especially now that with the disappearance of the league offices and sort of the unification of the umpires under one umbrella. And I think eventually we're going to see the DH in the National League as well. I think it just makes sense if you're going to put a team in Montreal to put it in the same division as the Blue Jays and give the Blue Jays a national rival.
Jeff, thanks very much.
Thank you, Danny.
Hi again, everyone. Russ Taylor along with Dave Van Horn at Jerry Park in Montreal. Before we give you the starting lineups for tonight's game, let's pause 10 seconds for station identification. This is the Expos Baseball Network.
Our last guest this week is a man who needs no introduction to Expos fans. Dave Van Horn is a member of the Canadian Baseball Hall of Fame and a Ford Frick Award winner for his outstanding contributions to baseball as a broadcaster.
I was there for the birth of the Montreal franchise, April 8, 1969. A gray spring day at Shea Stadium, but sunlit across Canada. Being an American, I was new to Montreal, but how could you not be moved hearing O Canada for the first time in a major league ballpark? To look through my binoculars and see tears streaming down the faces of Charles Bronfman, the owner, and Mayor Jean Drapeau of Montreal, seated in the box seats. It was obvious to me what that moment meant to all of Canada. It was magic. 9 days later, I was sitting in the broadcast booth at Connie Mack Stadium, and I was broadcasting Bill Stoneman's no-hitter 9 days into my rookie season.
Throw to first, in time, he did it! A no-hitter, a no-hitter, a no-hitter for Bill Stoneman.
That was magic, too, and one of the first hints that nothing would be dull in my 32 years with the Expos.
He was the voice of the Expos from their inception in 1969 through the 2000 season. Before the team's uncertain future, both on the field and in the broadcast booth, compelled him to look elsewhere as he began his tenure with the Marlins. I began by asking Dave about how he secured the Expos play-by-play position way back when.
Well, that's a long story, but I'll make it short. When the leagues expanded in 1968, I had applied. I had to look at the sporting news to find out a contact in Montreal. And I found a fellow by the name of Jerry Snyder. He was a city councilman. And his was the only name that was showing, other than Mayor Jean Drapeau, on the list of executives in Montreal. And I thought, well, these are politicians. Who's the owner and what's going to happen up there? Anyway, I wound up writing a letter to Jerry Snyder. I got a response. He said, we'll file your letter and keep you in mind. That was the end of that. So, make a long story even longer, long about the time that they had put together the package with Charles Bronfman to supply the ownership and buy the franchise, and then picked Jerry Park with the help of my first broadcast partner, Russ Taylor. They found this spot in Jerry Park that they could convert into a 28,000-seat major league facility.
I'm afraid to mention the word problem because every time I mention it, the mayor would say, we have no problems, we only have solutions.
This formula implies the use of the stadium of the Jarry Park in Montreal, which stadium the city will bring up to the standards required by the National League of Baseball.
So they were going up there one night late in 1968 to check on the construction project itself. And when they were riding back downtown to the Windsor Hotel, which was then the Expos headquarters, John McHale said, I've got to hire another English broadcaster. We've got Russ Taylor on board, said I'd like to hire someone from the States that has been broadcasting baseball. Well, there was a fella in the back seat by the name of Lou Martin who had been brought up there from Richmond by John McHale to oversee the construction of the facility at Jerry Park. And Lou said, I can help you out with that. And John said, well, we've got 310 applications for the job, and I can't go through all of those. Maybe we can whittle it down to 5 or 10. And Lou said, I can whittle it down to 1 for you. You should hire the young broadcaster in Richmond, Dave Van Horn. Make a long story short, I met with John in West Palm Beach, and I was hired to serve as Russ Taylor's partner and broadcast the Expos games.
That is an amazing story. I hope you took Lou Martin out for a really nice steak dinner one night with a nice bottle of wine.
Oh, more than once. More than once. Yeah, I was coming and going at Gibby's with Lou for about 2 years.
That's nice. We all know that it was down to the last minute, literally, to get Jerry Park ready for Major League Baseball at the beginning of the 69 season. What do you remember about opening day, and what were the broadcast facilities like for you guys that day?
Well, the broadcast facilities in Jerry Park really were not bad, considering it was a temporary ballpark and a temporary setup. In other words, the broadcast facility was roomy, and it was fine. It was right behind home plate, a nice, cozy little baseball venue there, Jerry Park, in the corner of that huge municipal park, which is Jerry Park. So I remember, of course, the first time going into the broadcast booth there. We'd been on the road to open the season, and it was absolutely incredible. The broadcast facility was just fine. It was as good as many of the spring training facilities are these days. But the team opened up in New York and played on April 8, 1969, against the New York Mets at Shea Stadium.
Starting pitcher against the Expos that day on April the 8th was Tom Seaver, who knew everyone was a good pitcher, but not everyone knew he would win 25 games, lead the Mets to a World Series, and be named Sportsman of the Year. April 8th was not his day, and Gary Sutherland became the first Expo base runner. Montreal's most popular player in the early days was left fielder Mac Jones, who on this occasion drew the team's first free pass to first base, a walk.
When we stood for the anthems, and for the first time in a major league game, both the Canadian and the American anthem would be played. And we stood for those anthems, and I looked at my partner, Russ Taylor, and he had tears streaming down his face. And it just suddenly hit me, the emotional impact of Major League Baseball going to Canada had not only on Montrealers and Quebecers, but from coast to coast in Canada. And it was quite a beginning to my tenure there. And it was a lesson well learned from Russ Taylor, just how much this franchise meant to the country.
And just how much it still means. I mean, it's hard to believe it's, I guess, 14 years now since the Expos left. But there are still so many Expos fans. And that franchise, whether it was the great years or the early years, it still means so much to them. And everybody I've talked about who played for the Expos or was affiliated with the Expos has such fond memories of Montreal. What made it, whether it was the city or the fans or the environment in the ballpark, what made it a unique experience for you as a broadcaster?
All of those things. Jerry Park was, like a lot of spots in Canada, very uncomfortable in April and in September because of high winds and cooler temperatures and so forth. But boy, in those wonderful summer months, it was just a great, cozy venue. The fans were close to the field. And I think that, Dan, one of the reasons why the Expos are still in the hearts of so many Montrealers and Canadians, one, for a few years, they were the only team, and we had both national radio coverage and national television coverage. But the fact is, John McHale and his team of baseball executives built a wonderful farm system. And throughout the 70s, the build of that farm system led to the team competing for the first time in 1979 when they won 95 games and went right down to the final weekend before being eliminated. And most of those players were homegrown, players that the Montreal scouts went out and found, signed, sealed, and delivered, and broke into pro ball in the Montreal system, and then got to the major leagues together. They had some wonderful drafts. The list of names is just incredible throughout the 70s. And when that team competed in 1970, I mean, that was a Montreal team, homegrown. And I think that that meant so much to the fans that these were their guys. And that was the hook back then and carried them into the early 80s when they had
tremendous years at Olympic Stadium, drawing over 2 million a year and competing and wonderful talent on the field.
There's always a bond between a team's fan base and the players, but did it feel to you like it was special in Montreal? I know in football, I'm a Green Bay Packers fan, and it feels like a special relationship between the players and the fans in Green Bay, maybe because of how small the city is, the uniqueness of the market, and so forth. Did it feel like a special bond between the players and the fans in Montreal?
Yeah, I think so. During the early years when all of this was taking place and they were building the farm system and we had a lot of players from other organizations playing for the Montreal Expos, an expansion team, 7, 8, 9, at times 10 of those players lived all year round in Montreal. I think that attracted the fans' attention to the team as mm-hmm. well, the fact that those players became part of the community. And I think that went a long way toward the love affair that existed between the fans and the players. And the players felt that, too. You have talked, I'm sure, to many of the players from the past, and they all have absolutely loved their experience almost to a man in Montreal and with the fans.
This may be an unanswerable question, but in your 32 years there, did you have a favorite team or a favorite year specifically? The one that you think back of more often than any other group?
Yeah, it's really a tough question to answer. I've been asked many times, Dan, but as you can imagine, with 32 years there, seeing so much happen with that franchise, obviously the very first year. It was my first year as a major league broadcaster. It was a wonderful experience learning the game under manager Gene Mock and working with Russ Taylor, who was so valuable to me because he knew the history of baseball in Montreal and in Quebec and in Canada. And he taught me so much about the feel of the fans in Montreal. But having Gene Mock as our manager was a wonderful experience. And then watching them build that farm system, it was just great. So 1969 stands out for that reason. I still think that 1994, that team was the best team in baseball. And tragically, the strike took place and the carpet was pulled out from under that team, as well as other teams. But the Expos at the time had the best record in baseball. It was a wonderful team. Didn't have quite the number of superstars because some had departed the scene, like Gary Carter and some others. But it was a terrific team in 94, best record in baseball, and it came to a crashing halt. At the same time, they had a terrific movement underway to build a downtown retractable roof that worked, ballpark, and that went down the drain as well with that 94 strike. So 94 really stands out. Probably the best team, and perhaps not the best overall talent, but played together as a team, and Felipe Alou was a marvelous manager. Those 2 years really stand out, but that's difficult for me to pick 2 years because I enjoyed everything except the last 5 or 6 years when
right.
there was that downward spiral and we knew that the end was near.
Right, and that's an impact, obviously, of 94. As well, unfortunately. One of the amazing things about that 94 team that I didn't realize until I looked it up, if you look at every significant player on that team that year, one of them was over 30 years of age. They had players from 21 through 28, really, that were the core of that team. And it's not just 94, and it's who knows what, we'll never know, but who knows what might have been in 95, 96, 97 for that group as well, because many of them were not even in their prime yet in 1994.
Well, that's so true, and there was a great feeling of camaraderie with that team. They were really close. The players loved one another, and it was a very special team. They started out coming together in 93. You look back at the 1993 season, and they had a good year, but nothing like 1994. I'll always remember that 94 season. When we were flying back from Pittsburgh and had lost the last game of the Pirate Series and we're flying back to Montreal, I talked on the plane to the player rep, Steve Rogers, and I said, this is going to be okay, right? We're going to be out maybe 24, 48 hours, and then the cooler heads will prevail. And he said, I'm not too sure about that, Dave. And it was just an awful feeling that I took home out onto the West Island in Montreal that night after we had landed. I know that Steve was very close to the powers that be in that Players Association, and I knew that he did not think that this was going to end in a day or so. But when I got on the plane, before I talked to Steve, I felt, relax, fellas, this will be okay. This will be over with in a day or two. And, of course, that it wasn't, and it was a historic end in that everything was canceled, not just the balance of the schedule, but the postseason play as well.
Yeah. If we can fast forward, the Expos' last home game was at the end of the 2004 season, and as fate would have it, the team you were broadcasting for at that time and still now, the Marlins, they were the opponent. They were the opposing team. So you were at Olympic Stadium for the Expos' last ever home game in 2004. And just as somebody who has spent 32 years in Montreal, what was that night like for you?
Very emotional. And I was invited by Mitch Melnick and the crew to come over and broadcast an inning on the Expos broadcast that night. It was very difficult for me to get through that broadcast without breaking down. It was an emotional night for me. I could see it in the eyes of others. I remember talking to Claude Raymond that night, and while we spoke, he had tears coming down his cheeks. And I knew how this would impact so many people and the love of that franchise coming to an end there. And it was a very difficult night to broadcast.
Well, here's hoping, and I know I'm sure you feel the same way. You know, here's hoping whether it takes 2 years or 20 years that Montreal gets a team back and that they're known as the Expos and that a new, you know, a new generation of fans and memories can be created. They were a wonderful part of Major League Baseball, so popular with Canadian fans. You still see people wearing Expo hats and jerseys and so forth, not just in Canada, in the U.S. in ballparks as well. And watching you do games, Dave, was a big, big part of that. I really appreciate you taking the time and helping us relive part of the Expos history.
Well, it was a wonderful and rich history for the most part, and I was proud to be a part of it, Dan.
And that's going to do it for this week's edition of A Swing and a Belt, as we got a complete look at the history, the emotions, the uniqueness, and the passion that many people had and still have for the Montreal Expos. Who knows? Maybe one day we'll all be lucky enough that there will be a Major League Baseball team again in Montreal, and hopefully they'll be called the Expos. To their fans, they will always be known as Nos Amour.
I am here today to confirm many of the rumors and innuendo and everything else that's been out there regarding the relocation of this franchise from Montreal to Washington, D.C.
Bad insult to injury. The Montreal Expos just lost the last game they played in Montreal by the score of 9-1 to the Florida Marlins. Really a bitter end to the team that brought Major League Baseball to Canada.
I think a lot of the fans got turned off. I mean, fans like to grow with players. I mean, and they didn't have that opportunity, I think, with that ball club.
It's just a real sad day, as I said, for baseball and for Montreal.
I'm very upset. I come from Winnipeg, and I've gone through all the Jets. And I remember people crying at the arena when the Jets left, and this is pretty much the same atmosphere. I just hope that Montreal gets the team back again.
Evidently, it was a good place for baseball, else it wouldn't have lasted this long.
They were called Nos Amours, and for three decades, Montrealers had a love affair with baseball. In the early years, the Expos packed Jerry Park and then the Olympic Stadium.
All right, folks, you know that's going to do it. 36 great years of history in Montreal has come to an end. The lights are still on, but they will go out very soon. We wish them all the best of luck as they take their act to Washington, D.C. And Washington, if you're watching, you're getting a good team. From all of us to you, au revoir from Montreal.